Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will be talking for the next few minutes about an extraordinarily interesting book called How to Survive a Plague, the inside story of how citizens and science tamed AIDS. Already this book is being called the definitive account of the terror which gripped the gay community in the early 1980s with the emergence of a devastating and utterly mysterious disease, an array of different ailments that claim the lives of otherwise perfectly healthy young people. And of course, the mystery only deepened over time, and silence from some quarters that might have made a real difference in the early days of the epidemic was only compounding the tragedy and multiplying its ultimate toll. Heroic stories emerge from that story, and the story is also one of conflicted figures who are heroic in some ways and in other ways self-serving, or in other ways maybe ethically flawed, as we all are, of course, in some ways. But it just deepens the way in which this story is so fascinating. And it is told in remarkable detail by author David France, already highly regarded for his previous book called Our Fathers, which looked into the scourge of Catholic sexual abuse by priests, which was adapted, of course, into a very fine film. Again, this current book is called How to Survive a Plague, the Inside Story of How Citizens and Science Tamed AIDS, published by Knopf. David France, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
One of the things that I find especially interesting and even remarkable about your book is that although it is a painstakingly researched account of what these of this the early days of the AIDS epidemic, it is also your own personal story. You were, in a sense, on the scene as this disease emerged. Could you just say a word about the challenge of crafting a book that was, on the one hand, laying out the broad sort of canvas of these events, and yet at the same time your own personal story of witnessing this yourself?
Well, it is, you're right, a witness account. And like all witness accounts of major historical events, much of the perspective depends on who's witnessing it. So I felt it really my responsibility to introduce myself to the reader and to let the reader know why I was seeing what I was seeing and why I was reporting on it the way I was. And it's a very intimate look at the plague. It's people's stories, really, about their call to action and the duties that they assigned themselves at a time when death was just all around us. And I also assigned myself a responsibility. I had moved to New York just several weeks before the first reports of the epidemic were in the New York Times. At the time, only 41 people infected. And those of us who were in the community that was apparently targeted with this infection felt a burden to do something. And what I assigned myself was the role of journalist and really of witness. Hmm. And so I kind of narrate through this 15-year history up to the development of the drugs that made it possible to survive an HIV infection and ended the plague years through my own prism, but also as a deep and scholarly history of that time.
Right. And I so appreciate that both of these elements are there, including, you tell us, the moment when you went to your school's library card catalog, realizing for the first time that you were homosexual and trying to find out what that meant and pulling out the card catalog. And there, right just past homogeneous, right before Homo sapiens, is homosexuality, see sexuality, comma, deviant. And in a moment, you know, you understood how the world saw this at that moment in time, which also helps explain something really remarkable. You say that when this first article appeared in the New York Times about this as yet completely mysterious and unnamed disease, although called maybe gay cancer, you said you were more annoyed than alarmed by the news. Explain to our listeners why you greeted this article in this way.
Well, I saw it as just another slander. It seemed it was just plain to anybody at the time who was in the gay community that nothing that was being said about us or promulgated about us or definitively announced about us was true. It just wasn't true. And we had so much distance to go to establish our humanity in the eyes of civic life, that it was not a surprise to read lies about us in every major paper, to hear lies about us on television. We weren't allowed on television at that point. There were no gay characters in any television shows. There were no gay public figures. We were illegal in most states. Most states had laws that criminalized homosexual activity.
And you mentioned that some, it was even a felony, right?
Felonies, absolutely. And, none of this made any sense to us. We knew that the world was upside down. It was a world gone mad. And then comes a report saying that somehow there's a disease that is able to discern one's homosexuality and then attack you as a result of that. And it was welcomed in many quarters. You remember that this was the rise of the first rise of the Christian right, whose wave brought Ronald Reagan's administration into power. And they celebrated the announcement of a gay-targeted disease as being proof of what they had been saying from their religious dogma all the years, that this was evidence that God hated gay people and that homosexuality was not just revolting but sinful and worthy of punishment in this way. So we were, when AIDS first washed in, the gay community was as far away as imaginable from any sort of kind of political power and any sort of agency over our own lives. And we had a long way to go to be able to fight the epidemic when no one else was doing it.
Right. One of the things that, of course, did ultimately make that fight possible was the fact that so many gay people had come to New York City, including you, in what you describe at one point in really apt language as a vast gay reverse diaspora. Born into exile and separated from our own kind, we were reassembling in a place that had only existed in the imagination, the new city of friends, conjured by Walt Whitman 100 years before. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, on the one hand, one of the reasons this terrible thing spread as it did was the concentration of this population. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, that also was the mechanism, in a sense, of the means by which ultimately you could collectively take hold of this issue and fight against it, in a sense.
And wrestle it to the ground. You're absolutely right. Think of this as being kind of ancient history, although it was only 35 years ago. And the distance that gay rights has traveled in 35 years is probably one of the most rapid and remarkable cultural transformations in history, that we went from being hated in polls by the majority of Americans to where we are today, which is really remarkable. We're integrated and celebrated in every aspect of civic life.
But it's so important to remember that this disease emerged at a point in time when none of that was yet in place. And in some respects, at that point in time, it was probably difficult to even conceive of such a new reality emerging in your own lifetimes.
There was an interesting moment in the early 80s where activists were protesting and trying to get some sort of attention, political attention, drawn to this epidemic for funding and for any sort of research or prevention efforts. And one of the elected politicians in New York responded by saying, look, they're out there demanding this and demanding that, and next thing you know, they're going to be asking for marriage licenses. And it was a funny moment because the furthest thing from our minds were marriage licenses. And yet the momentum that was established through the fight against AIDS ultimately led to that.
We're speaking with David France about his remarkable new book called How to Survive a Plague, the inside story of how citizens and science tamed AIDS. One of the heroes of your book is Dr. Joe Sonnenbend, who was a specialist in infectious diseases. He had a private practice where he diagnosed and treated gay men with venereal disease. He himself was gay, part of a generation of out-of-the-closet physicians and other medical practitioners who played a very significant role, needless to say, in the earliest days of this epidemic. One of the most fascinating things about his particular story and his efforts to try to figure out what in the world was going on was when he found himself gravitating towards one particular theory about what the cause of this was. And he was gravitating towards the immune overload model versus the new germ model, not at least entirely or even mostly for scientific reasons, but in a sense more because of sociological reasons about what the implication might be for the wider public if this new disease was caused by the one versus the other. Explain that. I think it's one of the most interesting facets of this story.
Well, scientifically, and he was a research scientist, he believed that because of the multitude of infections that people were suffering and the apparent underlying suppression of the immune system, he believed that there must be multiple causes for this. And he felt that the scientific community too rapidly turned to the theory that there was a new bug that was that was causing this total, you know, depletion of the immune system, and they didn't find that bug for many years, but they invested all of their interest in, and attention in it, in part according to his way of thinking, because they saw not the human suffering, but so much as they saw the possibility of a Nobel Prize. You identify a brand new agent, and it's likely to get you the attention of Sweden. And in fact, that did happen ultimately in the last decade. But he also feared that given how hated gay men were, that politically, the idea that a single agent was causing this threatened to encourage people to think that the way to counter this was to isolate gay people.
Right.
It was happening. We had at least 20 states were debating legislation on quarantine for gay people. The federal government was discussing it at the highest levels in the Reagan administration. It was a prevailing theory about how to contain the epidemic.
Right. You tell us that he feared if one was thinking along that model of a new strange germ with a predilection for attacking gay men specifically, that this was just playing into the hands of the religious right and would just fan the flames of anti-gay hatred, which was so prevalent. Another interesting moment in the early days of this epidemic is when you talk about some of the first calls that occurred in a publication called The New York Native, which had was really for written with gays in mind, and that was really the only place for a while where one could find good information about this new epidemic. Mm-hmm. But when the first suggestion was made about the possibility that maybe gay men need to curb or control their sexual activity to some extent, at least for some, that suggestion was met with outrage, because it came at, in a sense, exactly the wrong moment. Mm-hmm. It came in the midst of a time in history that most of us have forgotten. Explain that.
Well, not only this mass migration to the cities, but the modern gay movement was launched in 1969 with a riot at a New York gay bar called the Stonewall against police harassment and the mafia control of gay social life. The movement was only 11 years old, maybe 12 years old, when HIV entered. And in that 12 years, there was launched this migration, as we've discussed, and this celebration for the first time of a gay community, and with all that entails. It came out of the summer of love, the 60s ethos of free love and sexual expression, but it was also a response to decades, if not centuries, of repression of gay male sexuality and lesbian sexuality. And so it was kind of a political act to build a community around sexual love. So when the first hints came from some of the gay doctors back then that maybe this is caused by either repeated exposure to sexually transmitted diseases, which Dr. Sonnabend theorized, or a new agent, which others theorized, it's likely to be sexually transmitted, and that maybe we had to rethink that part of the community's thinking about itself. And for some, that came as another slander. You know, it came as this idea that the thing that we had finally been able to engage in openly and with celebration was being suggested to us to have some sort of deleterious impact. And many people in the community responded very angrily or warily initially to that. But that didn't last long. You know, by 1983, when the idea of safe sex was first developed, it was a way to still engage in sexual love, but to do it safely. And it was a way for the community to take care of itself and to protect itself and to protect one another. And that took off as a craze, not just in New York, but across the country. And we saw an immediate drop in sexually transmitted diseases and HIV co-infections from 1983 onward.
Can you just say a quick word about the two gentlemen who co-wrote the article that really presented the notion of safe sex for the mm-hmm. first time, and really the difficult gauntlet that represented to try to frame such an idea in just the right way?
I should preface this by saying this was all before social media. It was all before the internet. It was at a time when to communicate within the community was, akin to relying on smoke signals. So two patients of Joe Sonnabend's, Michael Callan and Richard Berkowitz, took on the role of trying to advise the community to what they should be doing with their lives, how they should be interacting with their doctors, what they should be allowing their doctors to do and not do. And they became the first kind of public personas in the epidemic. They initially were calling upon the community to forego sex in the interim until we could figure out what was going on. And about 2 years into their campaign, they started realizing that if simple ideas about disease transmission, that it probably involved bodily fluids, and that you could still have an intimate relationship without exchanging bodily fluids. And that seems like such a simple idea to us today, but back then it was a novel idea, and it was developed by these two folks, neither of whom were doctors. One was a singer-songwriter, and the other was a sex worker. And when they came to this conclusion, they produced a booklet which they called How to Have Sex in an Epidemic, published it with their own monies, and distributed it through New York, and ultimately, globally, they were sending crates of this booklet to Europe. It traveled to North America. It reached the far corners of the gay community in a way that you could actually chart how effective it was. And so they saved lives. But as they were finishing their book, they read the booklet to one another, they read it to their doctor, and Michael Kellen's lover listened in, and he said, "You've written 16 pages about sex and sexual activity, and you never mentioned the word love once." And they went back to their text with some startlement, and realized what they were talking about was love. They were talking about love for the community. They were talking about love for them, for oneself, and that that's what they were really promulgating, was this idea that the community had a responsibility to itself and to one another, and that this was the way to behave ethically in a time of danger.
We all are aware of the silence from the federal government, particularly from President Reagan. It took him many years before he ever spoke out specifically on this particular matter. Mm-hmm. And of course, in other respects too, the federal government seems to have been slow to respond. One thing that surprised me in the book was I did not realize to what an extent the New York Times had been relatively silent. You tell us mm-hmm. that it took 2 years and almost 600 dead before the New York Times put a story about this on the front page. And you also tell us that Senator Edward Koch was relatively silent on this matter. Can you just say a quick word about that and what kind of difference you think that made?
I think it made all the difference in the world, but it was all about this kind of shared disregard for gay lives. And the New York Times, when they reported the very first story in July of 1981, it was a tiny article back on page 21 of the paper, and reporting on this very unusual and challenging series of deaths. And we knew, because it happened just a number of years earlier, that Legionnaires' disease, which affected far fewer people, and killed ultimately, I think, 147, was front page news and merited the response of every aspect of the public health system. Epidemiologists were on the ground. Researchers were on the ground. It was a multi-million dollar effort, which in 6 months was able to solve the problem of Legionnaires' disease. So we knew that we were being treated in a very different way. None of the efforts of campaigning the New York Times to cover the story aggressively paid off at all. Certainly, not even with that first front page story. It was very behind on the reporting of the epidemic, and remained that way for most of the first decade of the epidemic. And this was coupled by the fact that the New York Times had a formal policy of refusing to use the word gay or lesbian to describe gay people. Their policy was to call us homosexuals, which is a term that describes only one's activities and not one's identity. They had a policy of not, in obituaries, of not mentioning the surviving partners of the dead, and that gave the impression that the dead were dying in isolation and in small pockets of despair instead of in the embrace of this large and mobilized community. So they were engaged in creating a myth of who we were in other aspects of the paper, and that really influenced the way they covered the science of the disease.
Your book lays out the story of what you call the vulgar rivalry that emerged between competing scientists racing to identify the ultimate culprit in all this, namely, of course, the AIDS virus. And I don't want to shortchange that story, which is quite fascinating, and I'm sure that story has never been told in such arresting detail as it is in your book. I think it would be more interesting for our listeners for us to spend a couple minutes talking about someone else whose name is going to be utterly unknown to the public, namely someone named Spencer Cox, who was a very important AIDS activist, but again, to a large extent forgotten, and even at the time of his death, tragically, sadly, largely forgotten even by many of his own community. Say what his most important contribution was to all this, the notion of drug trial innovations, which really made a big difference in all this.
He really was a seminal figure in the community's response to the epidemic. He came in a kind of a second wave of activism around AIDS, the first wave starting with Michael Callan et al., the second wave took foot in 1987 with the advent of kind of a broad coalition of grassroots social justice activists who pulled together to express the community's outrage, really, about what was happening. It finally became clear that the research machinery in the country really had not been engaged. There was very little going on in the area of drug research or basic science research or funding for prevention. Although we were 6 years into the epidemic and already 500,000 people around the world dead of the disease, there was this kind of institutionalized neglect that was that needed addressing. There was an organization started in New York called ACT UP, which adopted the purpose of making sure that people were held accountable for this. Spencer joined ACT UP as a 20-year-old college dropout, and helped to form a group within ACT UP called the Treatment and Data Committee. Treatment and Data took it upon themselves to try and understand what the basic science was, what research needed to address, and how to get them to do it. So he became kind of the nucleus of these treatment activists, these citizen scientists, who taught themselves the fundamentals of immunology and biology and virology and the like, and began to engage in a conversation with the scientists at the bench. And that effort ultimately culminated in the drug breakthrough in 1996 that they were so instrumental in bringing about. And Spencer was a key player in this aspect of it because he was the person who designed the drug trial protocol for the new class of drugs that were emerging in the laboratories in late 95. Came up with an idea about how to test them quickly, how to understand their interactions with other drugs, and how to get answers that are reliable, so that if the drugs were working, we would know how well they would work, and we could bring them to market right away. That's really, you know, biomedical statistics was the field that he learned to specialize in, although he had been studying acting and had never shown any skills in the area of science, but in his need to find an answer for himself and for others, he took on that role and did it brilliantly and did it quietly. I mean, biomedical statisticians are hardly ever celebrated, much less those who have not even a BS behind them. But I think the fact that 18 million people are alive today on those drugs owes in part to the brilliance of what Spencer Cox brought to this fight.
Right. And I guess one of the reasons it's important for us to think about him, I mean, you really open your book with his funeral in 2013, and and lay out so much of what he experienced, including great, great sadness and even bitterness by the end of his life, with frustrations at what had not been accomplished and to the extent to which he had even himself been forgotten. But you all, he is a great example, and just one of many examples of people who found themselves rising to the occasion in extraordinary fashion, and in many cases drawing upon gifts that they didn't even know they had, and or launching initiatives with little or no experience or demonstrable skill, but somehow in the midst of this crisis and disaster, managing to do truly amazing things.
And it's because it had to be done. I mean, nobody else was doing it, and that's what we realized 6 years in, that if our community couldn't rise up and do this, nobody was going to do it. We were all doomed. 8 million of us were infected by that point with HIV, and there was no promise of any development in the future. And, you know, at first, the activists were just stood outside the door of the FDA, for example, and just demanded drugs. Their rallying cry was drugs into bodies. And then it became apparent that nobody doing the research had any idea what kind of drugs or how to organize the research or how to prioritize the research. And that's the task that they realized, that if they didn't do it, it wasn't going to get done. There was nobody in the federal government, there was nobody in the public health administration who was doing any of that strategic work, and that's what they had to take on, and did so brilliantly.
A last question. I wonder what it was like for you on a more personal level to revisit this history of the AIDS crisis, and in particular this point of your own life. And telling the story about something which, of course, is still with us. You say at one point, though, so much has changed, so much is still the same. But what sort of personal cost was there for you to revisit these really, really tragic days?
The reason I opened the book with Spencer's story is because Spencer was brilliant, and he knew after 96, when surviving an HIV infection became possible, when the plague years came to an end, that what we had witnessed, what we had lived through, had huge psychological costs. And he turned his attention after 96 to studying and trying to make sense of the condition of survival through a mass death experience like the plague years had been. And he didn't make much progress on that. He had trouble finding funding. That's part of the embitterment that you were describing earlier. But he identified it, and he saw where the community was heading. And I think the reason, certainly, that I wanted to go back and tell this story is to find out what meaning we can wrest from having gone through this experience. What is the condition of survival? What does it mean to suddenly face ongoingness after a period in which we all couldn't see the future? And so that, for me, was the difficult task, was to go back and re-examine and sift through that history to see what it did to us and how it injured us, and to revisit that was painful, obviously. And I realized that the problem that we all have kind of emerged into this present day with is not just unprocessed grief, which we all certainly have, but it's also having to try to find some way to reconcile ourselves with this knowledge that our government and our major institutions in American life and even our churches and religious institutions, and including our families in many instances, had turned their backs on us. And there hasn't been a period of reconciliation around that. And the What that knowledge does, that realization does to a people, is severe and is lasting.
Right. And I suppose one of the important things you have done here is what I suppose somebody might uncharitably describe as reopening old wounds, in reminding all of us of this really, really sad and troubling reality. But I think your point is that that those are wounds that were never healed over, never properly addressed really at all, and that is probably one important purpose of your book, is to wrestle with this tragic reality.
Well, that was certainly my aim, and I hope people who read the book come away with some understanding of what this history has meant, both to American life and to a great number of Americans.
David France, his book is How to Survive a Plague, the inside story of how citizens and science tamed AIDS, published by Alfred A. Knopf. To finish out the hour, I want to read you a portion of David France's book. This is from a chapter titled Testing Limits. By this point in his chronicle of the AIDS crisis, it is 1985. The shocking news has just been revealed that former movie star Rock Hudson is dying of AIDS. This is also around the time of the emergence of the story of a 13-year-old hemophiliac in a small community in Indiana, a young man named Ryan White, who came down with AIDS because of tainted blood products and who faces the hostility of his whole community. It is also around this time that we see the creation of a group called GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Here is part of that story. A few writers from the Native joined a number of veteran activists and intellectuals on October 30th to craft a response to the escalating hostility from mainstream media, which Gregory Kolovaskis, a boyish translator of Mario Vargas Llosa, said posed the greatest threat to our freedoms and civil liberties that we've faced since Stonewall. They didn't know how to stop it, but were prepared to stage direct action in the streets after what had been years of post-Stonewall docility. The silence only connotes complacency within our community, Kolovakis said. But I know that there is a lot of anger, fear, and a real sense that we can't be beaten down anymore over fake issues and misrepresentations. To make their goals plain, the group called itself the Gay and Lesbian Anti-Defamation League and crafted a mission statement similar to the one that B'nai B'rith had used to guide their Anti-Defamation League since 1913. They would secure justice and fair treatment towards lesbians and gays and respond wherever untruths about gay lives were being trafficked. But almost as soon as they put out a call for a town hall meeting to announce their formation, came cease and desist warnings from, of all places, the very Jewish group they so admired. The Anti-Defamation League felt defamed by association with the gays. They threatened legal action, forcing the new group to change its name to the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, or GLAAD. The town hall meeting was held on November 14th, an unusually warm late autumn night. A fluorescent sliver of moon hung in the sky. More than 700 people descended on the Metropolitan Duane United Methodist Church on West 13th Street in Greenwich Village. They filled the pews, then the choir lofts. Bodies choked the aisles and vestries and snaked out the door. It was the most people inside the sanctuary that the church's administrator had ever seen, even counting Easter and Christmas. It may have been the largest political summit of gay men and lesbians in the city's history. The energy was as electrifying as the night sky. Most in attendance were middle-class liberals who had never taken a public stand for their rights. But a few were familiar faces in the movement, the street transgender activist Marsha P. Johnson and the feminist author Joelle Gomez, both African-American, who brought a breadth of experience and class consciousness to this still leaderless assemblage. I arrived late, but in time to hear the speakers call for the formation of a massive street protest at the doorstep of my new employer. "Bring your old rag," someone shouted, "to throw at that old rag." The restless crowd whistled and clapped. A man few people recognize moved to the front of the church's nave. Daryl Yates Rist, in his mid-30s, was a darkly handsome man and a fine dresser, favoring three-piece suits to complement a lavish mustache and, usually, a downturned face. I knew him from The Native, where he submitted occasional pieces remarkable for their gravity. I had not known him to be a rousing speaker, but these times had called him to eloquence and rage. He glowered over the room, then jabbed the air with a finger. "Many of us had to live a lie too long," he began. "We spent agonizing years believing lies about ourselves, hideous lies that fed self-hate, that ate away at us until we feared that any minute we would be destroyed. These lies sneered that we are sinful, we are moral blights, we are sick, we are desperate, we're violent, and more than normal people prone to heinous crimes. Lies that we recruit young children and innocent adults, that we cannot love, that we're unlovable, we're sexually obsessed, that we're all promiscuous, that our relationships don't last, that we spread disease, emotional and physical, that good, clean folks can catch perversion or a deadly germ by simply being near us in a room. Lies. That we cannot control our genitals as heterosexuals can, that therefore straight folks must control us." A furious ovation interrupted him. "Otherwise, we won't stop copulating as we wish, without a conscience, without precaution, without responsibility, until we've killed ourselves, for we are suicidal, and killed others, for we are homicidal, too. All of these are lies, and we are sick of lies." The audience responded as to a Dust Bowl revivalist, hands in the air. Their sense of having been mischaracterized was universal. Rist delved into history, his own and our collective stories, through the 1950s and our stymied puberties, past the fires of Stonewall and the anarchy of passion that followed alongside gay liberation. Not that all the vulgar lies about us ceased, but they seemed at times to be contained, he said. Things appeared to change, slowly, haltingly, and then our progress more and more took on a steady pace. Those were heady days. Gay and lesbian pride from San Francisco to New York and countless places we thought in between. It seemed sometimes that we were free. He looked around the room at the many young faces. Their faces showed portent, surely, and frustration, and fear, not defiance. "Then AIDS," he said. How soon the bigots made the issue theirs, manipulating tragedy with hate. GRID, they jumped to call it. Gay-related immune deficiency, as though just what they'd always said was true, that we were not like other human beings, and this was proof, our very own disease. Or, more spiteful still, that we were damned because of who we are, to suffer tortured early deaths, a godly retribution. And from the very time this illness was identified, the air has swarmed with lies, in the street, in the press, and in the legislative halls. Listen to the lies. AIDS is a gay disease, when in the worldwide epidemic, it is straight, striking men and women equally whenever it occurs in Africa. And as the New York Times wrote just last week, spread through conventional sexual intercourse, that offensive adjective. AIDS is not now gay, nor has it ever been. Listen to the lies. Gays getting buggered by infected boys in Haiti brought AIDS here. But as the Centers for Disease Control too quietly announced, the first AIDS case was not a gay man in 1979, the mythic epidemic starting point, but a San Francisco woman in 1976, heterosexual, an IV drug abuser 3 years before a case of homosexual AIDS was diagnosed. But addicts often die in slums or in the streets, their deaths conveniently and callously ascribed to overdose, whether that's what's really it or not. And as some epidemiologists, even some inside the CDC, confess, if there was one IV drug-related case in 1976 when no one had yet pinned a name on AIDS, there were many others, maybe hundreds, before one gay man got sick. However AIDS arrived, gay men didn't start it in their rectums. Listen to the lies. AIDS-infected gay men poisoned the U.S. blood supply. But it was American pharmaceutical companies which in the 70s were buying plasma from the destitute in Africa, the Caribbean, and Central America, from some of the very countries where AIDS is killing rampantly. And as late as 1982, some of these companies purchased plasma from U.S. prisoners who, according to investigators, had tracks of needle marks running up their arms from recent drug abuse. This was plasma which became the clotting factors used by hemophiliacs, whose AIDS infections and whose deaths were wholly blamed on homosexuals. but gay men will not submit to lies and bear the wretched burden of this guilt. Listen to the lies. That this country cares about our lives, that it is looking for a cure for AIDS as feverishly as it would if the victims of this horror were all straight. Listen to the lies that the U.S. government, the CDC, the medical establishment grieve that some 10,000 of us have been stricken, mourn our dead, now more than 5,000, pray that not one more of us will die. Listen to the lies that our sorrow has torn this nation, wrenched it just as horribly as it would if the epidemic were destroying not gay men, but husbands and their wives. His audience rose angrily to pound out applause, denouncing the nation whose cavalry never came. Rist waited for them to settle into their pews before he continued. We have not forgotten that the New York Times cared very little, very late. We do not forget that the Daily News still likes to paint gay sex as scandal. And the New York Post, we will not be satisfied until this nasty piece of lunacy has folded. There is no place for journalistic filth like that in any sane society. The room now sparked with the energy of an angry mob. The community had found its rage, given to them by a largely unknown man with his unexpected, powerful speech. For that moment, at least, Daryl Yates Rist became the leader the community had been looking for. The look of burden was gone from the faces in the audience. Their voices were a roar of excitement. They spilled out into the city with a purpose and a plan. The rags protest at the New York Post would mark a new beginning. A portion from the chapter Testing Limits from David France's marvelous book, How to Survive a Plague, the inside story of how citizens and science tamed AIDS, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a very, very different topic. We're going to be talking in the first few minutes with Raghavan Iyer, who is the author of an intriguing cookbook called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried, too, which examines some of the wonderful ways in which one can prepare potatoes. In the second part of tomorrow's program, we will be talking with Carlo Caravatti. I'm sure many of you know him well. He is someone who has grown all kinds of different varieties of potatoes, and we'll be talking about all of that tomorrow. On Thursday, Art Sear joins us to offer his analysis of current events, but in the first few minutes of Thursday's program, we're going to be hearing from the president of the national organization Toys for Tots. On Friday, we'll hear, among other things, from the executive producer of a really fascinating National Geographic series called Mars, which is an intriguing blend of documentary and dramatized science fiction, which supposes how a manned mission to Mars might unfold in the year 2033. Looking ahead to Monday, a good friend of the morning show who has not been on the program in quite some time, therapist Amy Sprague Champeau, offering some thoughts on how we can make our way through what seems like a very prickly, divisive political landscape in these holiday seasons. How can we peacefully coexist, maybe with family and friends who see the world very differently from the way we do? On Tuesday, organizers from a group in Racine called Art Root. On Wednesday, the legendary lover Casanova. And a week from Thursday, the president of Gateway, Brian Albrecht. You find The Morning Show archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and laid